Welcome to Journal Club. Thanks for joining. And we have Philip Hurst, our pulmonary pathology fellow, who will present the first journal. Philip, please take it away.
Yeah, good morning. So the first article to discuss today is from Mino Knudsen et al. And they evaluated grading system using tumor budding for invasive squamous cell carcinoma of the lung and resection specimens. And I'll share my screen and just briefly go over the summary, and then we can discuss because I imagine there might be some discussion. So their background for the premise for their study was that they acknowledged that squamous cell carcinoma, of course, is a large portion of these tumors, 25% of lung cancers, but they don't have very strong molecular therapies. And although immunotherapy has shown some improvement, it is imperfect. There is no standardized grading system for lung squamous cell carcinomas, and the traditional grading, including things like basaloid features and keratinization, lack prognostic value. So they acknowledge that there are other studies, other groups who have attempted similar proposed systems in the past, including things such as budding, tumor nest size, nuclear size, etc. But all of these previous studies were single institutions and relatively limited. So their goal was to expand into a multi-institutional study and have, improved external validation. What they found was that tumor budding of all of the histologic features that we can discuss was the one that was consistently associated with recurrence-free survival and overall survival. They looked at evaluating the tumor buds with a three-tier system and a two-tier system, but ultimately found that the three-tier system did not carry significance, especially in that moderate number. So they just divided it down into low and high, and found strong prognostic separation. To do this, they took two training sets, one that had 262 and one that had 427 patients. And then they looked at, again, different histologic features, including tumor budding, nest size, nuclear size, spread through airspace, mitotic rate, necrosis, varying invasion patterns. And what they found across all of the sets, or both of the sets, I should say, was that tumor budding was statistically significant. So then they did a validation set of 127 cases, and that held up in those as well. The definition of tumor budding is, for them, is four or fewer tumor cells at the invasive front of the lesion, evaluated at a hot spot at a 200 per times magnification, which was normalized to a 0.785 millimeter square area. And like I said, they divided them into low grade and high grade, with 10 being the cutoff. So 10 or more tumor buds in one of those high power fields was considered high grade. Fewer than that would be low grade. They adjusted their statistics for the recurrence-free survival and overall survival by age, sex, and stage. And when they did this, they found that there was significantly worse recurrence-free survival and overall survival for people who had high-grade tumor budding. This also applied within stage, within the AJCC staging. So people with stage one disease that had high-grade still had worse recurrence-free survival even within the stage. And then their argument for why this is good is because there is better agreement. It's a single parameter evaluation for these histologic, grading systems. They say that it's simple, reproducible, and requires no special stains. They claim that it outperforms prior multi-parameter systems, and has better external validation, so it may influence and benefit prognostic and theranostic management moving forward. So just to kind of demonstrate some of their examples, and then we can open it up to discussion. So this is what they show as a tumor bud. So they demonstrate here on the left photo, you can see what they call the advancing front of the lesion. And then zooming on higher power, you can see these small tumor buds of four or fewer cells. And then They also give a demonstration of how to identify these places, these hotspots, by, they say, scanning 10 individual fields at 10x to find a hotspot, and then going on to the 20x objective or 200 time magnification to find a 0.785 millimeter square area to count the tumor buds. So very brief, quick summary, but happy to discuss or try to attempt to clarify to the best of my ability.
Quick question, Philip. You said they said it was reproducible, so I suspect that means they did inter-observer correlations?
Statistics, yes, they did. Let me see here. Yes, they did provide that information. And it was like 80% had high agreement, about 50%, I think, was like perfect agreement, or maybe even less, but I can keep looking for that. I have it outlined somewhere. Somewhere. Reproducibility assessment. 10 observers reviewed whole site images. A complete agreement was seen in 48% of the cases, and an agreement of more than 80% between readers was seen in 19 out of 25 of the cases, resulting in an overall moderate agreement of a Fleiss kappa of 0.5, 95% CI.
How did they pick that unusual size of, you know, area to do the counting? I guess because what I'm thinking of is, I don't know, what, 10% of the U.S. pathologists are digitized? So how are those who aren't digitized supposed to do this? That's just a very specific little number.
Yeah. I mean, they provide, I mean, I guess it's the same. I mean, I don't know how they chose that specific area.
I mean, that's just a weird number. Yeah, I mean, it's not 2 millimeters squared. It's
right.
It's not 1 millimeter squared. It's like, anyway.
I don't know.
It's a 200x objective. It's a 200x field. That's what it is.
They
calculated the specimen area.
Okay. Yep. Okay. Thanks. Yep. I'm driving, like I said, so I can't like look at anything. So thanks.
So can you all imagine doing that? Maybe with the new WHO? I don't know if they push it in the new WHO or not, but thinking about what was done with the adenocarcinomas, it may come. I'm also wondering what the clinicians will do with the information.
I'm sorry, I missed just a moment of the presentation. Did this outperform conventional T-stage, or was it equivalent? Because I heard it was associated with worse prognosis, but is it more predictive than T-stage?
They were both significant. Dr. Roden and I were talking about this. They were both significant. I guess I don't know if it outperformed it. I think their argument is that it's simpler, but also, like I said, that even within the staging, their argument is that even within like stage one, for example, this adds additional prognostic value for patients in stage one, for example. So they're not arguing necessarily to replace T staging with it, but that to add it for additional, more granular prognostic benefit.
So if I'm understanding, because right now when we grade our tumors, it's well, moderately, poorly differentiated. So now we'll have a low and high grade?
Yeah, based on tumor budding. They make the argument in the paper that current grading system with keratinization, well, moderately, highly differentiated or poorly differentiated, has not well producible, reproducible prognostic value. So I think their argument is that we would completely do away with that and just use this, I guess.
All right. If there are no further questions, then thank you very much, Philip. Nice presentation. Let's move on to the next paper. And the next paper is by Lunardi And colleagues, including the senior author Fiorella Calabrese, all from Padua in Italy, and the title is Pathologic Assessment of Resected Stage 3 Non-Small Cell Lung Cancer After Neoadjuvant Chemotherapy, Identification of Additional Prognostic Factors. And this study basically follows the 2020 IASLC recommendations for the assessment of tumor bed, where we are supposed to calculate the percentage of the stroma, including inflammation and fibrosis, the percentage viable tumor and percentage necrosis, all adding up to 100%. And in their opinion, the inter-observer reproducibility of this method is quite challenging, and they are also thinking that additional markers may help in the prognostic or in the prognosis. So their aim was to assess features of histopathologic response to neoadjuvant platinum-based chemotherapy, focusing on tumor bed stromal components, so fibrosis and inflammation, using more objective and reproducible methodologies such as morphometry and artificial intelligence. It's a retrospective study, including 70 cases of stage 3 non-small cell patients. They all underwent surgery after neoadjuvant chemotherapy. Some of them had some additional therapies after surgery. They followed the 2021 WHO, the AIDS TNM staging, and then the 2020 IASLC tumor bed recommendations. They graded the inflammation based on the tissue involvement as mild, if it was involving less than 30%, moderate if it was 30 to 60%, and marked if it was over 60%. They performed computer-assisted morphometry, and for that, they actually tried to stain the fibrosis with Asian Mallory. I had to look it up. It's some kind of trichrome stain. And they also stained the lymphocytes with CD45 for the inflammatory component. In addition, they performed AI-based immune cell quantification for CD4, CD8, CD68, and FOXP3. They also kind of invented a composite clinical pathologic scoring. They called it the ClinPath. And they had three scores. Score A included MPR, so major pathologic response, if the percentage of viable tumor is 10% or less, plus baseline blood lymphocytes, perineural invasion, vascular invasion, proliferative index, and the extent of fibrosis. The score B was essentially score A plus CD4 positive cell percentage, and score C was essentially score A plus the FOXP3 positive cells. Interestingly, they did not provide any significant p-value. You know, usually we say p less than 0.05 was significant, but they used any kind of p-value, like even a 0.07 as significant. So that was a bit confusing in this study. But anyway, overall, they had 70 patients. There was a majority for adenocarcinoma. 17% of the patients had MPR. 7% had a complete pathologic response. Looking at the tumor bed, the median necrosis percentage was 5%, 55% for the viable tumor, and 30% for the stroma. When they performed morphometry, the fibrosis extension was a median of 22% and inflammation 24%. And just to illustrate that here in the figure 6, let's see here. This is the figure where they actually, how they performed the morphometry, or what the results of the morphometry was. So basically here in A, the result was 6% of fibrosis, and in E, 54%. And then B is the CD4 cell count or percentage. In B, it's 10%, and in F, 25%. So the results were that MPR was associated with lower frequency of stars, vascular and pleural invasion. It was also associated with higher extension of
Anya. Yeah, I think you muted yourself.
Oh, how was that possible? I was talking too much. Where did I stop? Do you know? Did you still see the figure?
Yeah, we can still see the figure. It was just for a few seconds, so.
Okay. So, essentially, NPR was associated with a lot of parameters, including lower frequency of stars, vascular and pleural invasion, higher extension of fibrosis, which totally makes sense. It was associated with lower ClinPass scores and any of these scores, and it was associated with longer disease-free survival. The complete pathologic response had no associations, but that was likely because only 7% of the cases had complete pathologic response. Also, if you just take the necrosis and the total stroma percentage, or the inflammation by itself, or the percent of viable tumor, none of those were of prognostic significance. Doing AI, they also identified that intermediate and high fibrosis extent was associated with longer disease-free survival. In the end, they looked at their combined scores and score B, which was basically MPR, baseline blood, lymphocytes, perineural invasion, vascular invasion, proliferative index, fibrosis, and the CD4 count was most associated with disease-free survival. So overall, MPR is a good prognostic parameter, but they think that MPR combined with other clinical and morphologic parameters and immune cells may correlate better with outcome than MPR alone. However, I have to say they did not do a multivariate analysis where you really could compare these kinds or a really comparison, statistical comparison of these measurements. So, I mean, it makes sense, I would say, but I also would say it would be very interesting now that we perform not only near-advent chemotherapy, but the chemotherapy plus immunotherapy, these things may also change. So any questions to the article?
Did they make specific recommendations or just say adding all this is better?
Yeah, that was essentially it. Yeah, no specific. And I mean, honestly, we can't really do it anyway. I mean, who can count the CD4 positive cells? That's, I think for now, this is pure research. I don't think it will make it to the new WHO. So we can still relax here. All right. One question for you regarding fibrosis. Are you using any stains for fibrosis, for the extent of fibrosis? I mean, we don't have to report it right now. We have to just report the percentage of viable tumor. But is anyone doing stains for fibrosis? No.
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 Yeah. All right. So let's move to the other article. This is an article by a Paris group. The first author is Helias Rosevich, and it is about ALK ATI drives nuclear anaplastic lymphoma kinase or ALK expression in histiocytic neoplasms without ALK fusions. And honestly, this caught my attention because I wasn't really thinking about ALK when I was thinking about histiocytosis. I always thought about BRAF, but they do make an argument for ALK here as well. So we know there's a spectrum of genetic alterations in histiocytosis, mainly the MAP kinase pathway, and that is where BRAF V600E comes in, but apparently ALK as well. And more recently, an ALK-positive histiocytosis, which they call ALK plus H, was included in the WHO as an entity. And this histiocytosis is defined by an oncogenic ALK fusion and strong cytoplasmic ALK staining. And apparently, this histiocytosis is responsive to ALK inhibitors. It has been described in extracutaneous and systemic juvenile xanthocarcinomas, but also in Ehrheim-Chester disease, and often involves neurologic symptoms. Now, also in previous studies, some histiocytosis, they do express the ALK protein, but do not have detectable ALK fusions. And more recently in melanoma, they did identify that as well, and they found an alternative mechanism of ALK activation, which they called the alternative transcription initiation, or ATI, and they found that this happened in intron 19 of ALK, and they called it an ALK ATI. And so this study here was to look for the frequency of ALK expression in histiocytosis without ALK fusion. It was a retrospective study. They used the cases from the French National Histiocytosis Registry. They used two ALK clones. Mainly, they used the clone 1A4, which is a highly sensitive ALK. And in some of the cases, they also used, in addition, the D5F3, which is actually the clone we currently use for the lung cancer adenocarcinoma evaluation. They performed custom RNA sequencing panel targeting the histiocytosis-related genes, and then they classified the histiocytosis based on ALK expression and oncogenic ALK fusion. So they had the ALK plus H, which are the histiocytosis that did express ALK, and they also had the fusion for ALK. They had then the ALK KPFN, which did express ALK, but did not have the fusion. And then the ALK KNFN, they did not express ALK, and they did not have the fusion. So in table two, you can see which histiocytosis were included. And so mainly Langerhans cell histiocytosis, then the type C, which is the mucocutaneous histiocytosis, some Rosai-Dorfmann, Ehrheim-Chester, and a few other ones. And then they performed the RNA ALK expression, and they found that only 8% of the cases actually expressed ALK and had the fusion. 16% of the cases expressed ALK but did not have the fusion, and the majority of the cases, almost 70%, did not express ALK and did not have the fusion. So that means ALK expression overall is more commonly not associated with the oncogenic fusion than with the oncogenic fusion. So then after RNA-seq, they wanted to know if these cases also actually expressed the protein, which the RNA can't really tell. So they studied about 60% of these cases, and they found that almost all of the ALK plus H cases also expressed the protein. 86% of the ALK RNA-seq positive cases, but fusion negative cases express the protein. And a few of the cases that did not have RNA expression and no fusion did actually express IHC. I found that interesting. Now, what was interesting was different expression patterns. So the cases that were ALK IHC positive and had the fusion had cytoplasmic expression. So what did they mean by this? This is this here in F, which is strong cytoplasmic staining, but the nuclei are negative. So if you blow it up here, you see the nuclei are actually negative and there's only cytoplasmic staining. So this is for the cases that had ALK expression and diffusion. And then the cases that did not have diffusion but ALK expression, you can see them in D, they have nuclear staining, and basically they stain anything. They stain the nucleus, the cytoplasm, and the membrane. So fusion negative cases show nuclear ALK staining, while the fusion positive cases show cytoplasmic staining. And then they looked for this ALK ATI isoform, and they found that all the cases that had ALK expression but no oncogenic driver mutation were driven by the ALK ATI isoform. So basically, what's the take-home message? The take-home message is that ALK can be expressed in histiocytosis. It's actually common, but it is not necessarily associated with an ALK oncogenic fusion. And that means that the ALK inhibitors may not work in all of the cases that show ALK expression. So they probably should do the fusion in these cases to see. And at this time, it's not entirely clear that whether the ALK ATI histiocytosis, so the ones that express the porcine but do not have the fusion, will actually react to the ALK inhibitors. So this was a bit difficult to swift through, but any questions to that?
Anya, thanks. Do they recommend that you use ALK diagnostically? Well, that really so wasn't the purpose of the study, but I, you know.
No.
We're always looking for help.
No, I don't think so. I don't think so. Maybe except for this entity, which is ALK positive and fusion positive, but then you would have to do the fusion as well. And for me, the main message here is that ALK inhibitors may work in some of these cases. But there was no strong recommendation to do that. But I would have to actually look into the WHO and see whether they recommended for this ALK plus H entity, which apparently you can see in some of the early type Chester diseases.
Okay, thanks.
Yeah. Does actually anyone get questions from the clinician to perform BRAF or ALK in these cases for treatment? Because I never have. I may do the BRAF for diagnostic purposes, but that's essentially it.
You know, I've never had anybody ask, but I had a case that Kirk Jones got involved with because it came as a consult and then the patient went to UCSF. And I sent it to Rochester for BRAF, and it was the fusion was negative. And at UCSF, they got it positive, I guess, because they're different primers. Is that right? I mean, it's a little bit above my molecular brain, but they found that it was positive. So, there are different ways to look for the same thing, right? So I don't know, but I've never had a clinician ask.
Interesting. Maybe Ying Chun can shed a light on that.
Yeah, so if the tumor percentage is low, then the fusion assay may not catch it, but the ddPCR may catch it. So I don't know the exact situation of the case, but I can imagine sometimes it may be missed by the fusion assay if the lesional cell percentage is low.
Yeah. This was actually on a cryobiopsy, so it wasn't a lot of tissue to begin with.
Mm-hmm.
Thanks.
I guess my understanding is for our histiocytosis, always to do a BRAF, especially Erdheim Chester or PLCH, as part of our kind of routine. That's what I got the sense from our quote unquote histocytic group here at Mayo. So at least by IHC, I always do it.
Yeah, I'm glad to hear you say that. I do it on my LCH cases as well, and then of course Erdheim Chester. So I typically do it on LCH, but I don't know. I noticed Brandon was on. I don't know if he routinely does it, for example.
I do, because I never know what the clinicians are going to want to do with the patient. I mean, most of the cases we see that need it are consults. So when dealing with somebody from the outside, it's easy enough to do and inexpensive, so I do it. I do it on all my Erdheim Chesters as well. But I don't know what the clinicians do with it.
So you don't do it for diagnostic purposes. You do it for clinical purposes, right?
Oh, I don't know what others do. For me personally, I do use BRAF V600E as a diagnostic tool in difficult Erdheim Chester cases.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't used it that way for LCH. I feel like LCH is pretty readily resolvable with, histology and when needed CD1A or longer. And I do it purely for potential therapeutic purposes on the LCH cases.
Yeah, I think on the LCH, if it's a very hard, there aren't a lot of cells, then if they're also BRAF positive, then that gives me some comfort. So I use it a little bit diagnostically.
Very good. Any other questions, comments? Okay. Then we'll move on to the last discussion article. And is Andras here? because Andras was a co-author on this article. This is from Salai and colleagues from the Semmelweis University in Budapest, but it's basically a multi-institutional study on GPNMB immunohistochemistry as a useful ancillary tool for the diagnosis of pulmonary lymphangioleiomyomatosis. So, as you know, LAM is driven by mutations in TSC1 or 2 genes, which then activates the mTOR pathway. We typically use the markers HMB45, MELAN-A, SMA, ER, PR. In this article, they also talk about beta-catenin, cytoplasmic. Not sure if I used that for that purpose. And now they propose GPNMB, which is the glycoprotein non-metastatic melanoma protein B, which is upregulated by the mTOR signaling. It is expressed in PCOMAs and TSC-related tumors. We, for instance, have it because of some of the kidney tumors. GPNMB is also potentially a predictive biomarker because tumors that do express that protein could respond to an antibody drug conjugate, which I can't pronounce. It's you can read it, clembuterol, whatever. So the aim was to evaluate GPNMB by immunohistochemistry as a diagnostic marker for pulmonary LAM and to distinguish LAM from its histologic mimickers. They included 15 LAM cases, 8 were biopsies, although I don't know how big the biopsies were, whether they were all surgical biopsies or other biopsies, and 7 explanted lungs. They also included 30 diagnostic mimics, including leiomyoma, benign metastasizing leiomyoma, leiomyosarcoma, and metastatic leiomyosarcoma. And then they included a whole bunch of pulmonary lesions, including solitary fibrous tumor, lung cancer, histiocytosis, and so on. Their positive controls were angiomyolipoma and the subependymal giant cell astrocytoma, or SEGA. And they used the clone E4D7P for GPNMB. They then calculated an H score as the intensity 0 through 3+, multiplied by the percentage of cells expressing GPNMB. If the H score was at least 100 or higher, this was considered as high. So for the results, let's go to the figure. Which you can see here, they found that the pulmonary macrophages did considerably express GPNMB, but everything else in the benign lung was negative, including the interstitium, the pneumocytes, and the bronchial and vascular smooth muscle. Then C and D are the positive controls, the angiomyolipoma and the SICA, which had a high H score. And then in E and F, we have a focus of pulmonary Langerhans cell histiocytosis. And in G and H, again, this is a focus of pulmonary Langerhans cell histiocytosis, showing the membranous, the cell membrane accentuations that was seen in some of the cases. So overall, this stain should be strong, finely granular cytoplasmic staining, also cell membrane accentuation in some of the cases, and in some of the cases, a perinuclear dot. All right, and so in all the mimics, which you can see here, the stain was negative. Here are all the mimics, negative, or they had an H score of less than 100. And similar for all the other lung cases. So when using an H score of at least 100, and you can see that here in figure 3A, all the LAM cases had an H score of over 100, and all the diagnostic mimickers had an H score of less than 100. So with that, using an H score of 100, the sensitivity, specificity, positive and negative predictive value of GPNMB for LAM was 100%. If they use any staining, so independent of what the H score is, then the sensitivity of GNBMB for the LAM is still 100%, but the specificity is only 60%, and the positive predictive value is 56%. There was also some correlation with the disease stage, as you can see here in figure 3b. The bilateral lung transplants, or better the explants, had a higher age score than the biopsies. However, there was no significant difference. So, as take-home message, GPNMB is highly sensitive and specific and a good ancillary marker for pulmonary LAM. It may be useful specifically in biopsies, and membrane expression or higher expression may predict response to, no, membrane expression may predict its response to GPNMB targeted therapies. So with that, there's also a figure four. What was figure four? Oh, figure four, they just show this focus of LAM and how all the other stains look like. So here's the SMA, the HMB45, GPNMB, and the ER. Now, they didn't compare the age scores between GPNMB and all the other markers that we usually use for LAM and how often the other markers were expressed. But I don't know what your experience is. Has any of you ever used GPNMB for the diagnosis of LAM? Oh, there was a poster at USCAP. Okay.
That's do we have it, Anya?
Maybe you I'll do. Jump in. And the poster was ours with our fellow, Dr. G. We were, of course, disappointed that Andrash beat us to the punch and got his paper published before we did. Ours should be coming out soon. But we have been using it. We've had it work really nicely in several cases of LAM that we've had on the consult service since we brought it up and validated it locally. The study that we did included things that were not included in the present study, which I think will also be interesting to the group. We included other cystic metastases in our series, endometrial stromal sarcoma, metastatic fibrohistiocytic tumors, some other things, and our results mirror what Andrash and his friends show here. We saw really nice staining in most cases with GPNMB. The only thing that ours kind of adds to this, in addition to those other cystic tumors, we actually included a metastatic non-LAM PEComa in our series, and not surprisingly, that is positive. So this is not specific to LAM. It stains any PEComa. So just be careful if there's a history of, you know, I think that one was a uterine PEComa, not LAM, and was strongly positive in the metastases in the lungs that kind of sort of looked like LAM. But anyway, we quite like it. In at least, I know that Dr. Smith has used it in at least one case and had a really nice result. I've had a couple. And it's particularly helpful for those cases where you're trying to prove it's LAM, but the HMB45 and the MELAN-A and the other sort of classic melanocytic markers are focal or minimally expressed, and you know it's got to be LAM, but you can't get the melanocytic markers to work. GPNMB seems to be a great tool, particularly in that context.
So did you compare it in your study to the other markers?
We did, yeah. And Selena, you would remember the specific data better than I would, since you were the one who counted things. So maybe you want to comment, but most cases that we performed it on had low level expression of the regular melanocytic markers, and every single one of them had at least 50% of the LAM cells staining with GPNMB. Most of them were greater than 75% of cells staining. It really does work well.
Yeah, I just want to jump in too. Thanks, Dr. Larson. Yeah, I think there was only one case that had a little bit less than 60% of GPNMB cell staining. But if I remember correctly, that case was also really old. I think it was, the slides were from 2013 or something. So it could be some issue with just like an older slide as well. And yeah, I think comparatively there were just a few cases where the GPNMB was also strongly expressing cases that had either one or I think it was just one of MELAN-A or HMB45. So we did compare the GPNMB staining in cases that were diagnostically more challenging, aka both melanin A and HMB45 were negative, and we also compared it to a case where it wasn't as difficult, so HMB45 or melanin A, one of them was positive.
So what would be the best panel if you would have this stain? Is there any good panel or the best panel based on your guys' study?
I don't know what the answer to that is. Max asked me this question about 2 weeks ago when he had his case, 2 or 3 weeks ago. And I recommended to him to perform GPNMB up front and also cathepsin K, which we have now. Some people have it. It's not as specific, but it also works really well in LAM when the melanocytic markers are minimally staining. So far, I've been adding on melanin A and HMB45 anyway, just to while we continue to gain experience with GPNMB, but I've added it as kind of first line staining for any case where I'm suspecting LAM. That's an N of one. I don't know if anybody else has done that.
You know, the challenge is most of our cases, our consults, and people will have done a certain number of these stains already. And, you know, they're minimal to negative, which, so I think, you know, this will be helpful. I also use beta-catenin sometimes. Cytoplasmic beta-catenin will highlight the cells when other, you know, when MART and other stuff is like weak or iffy. So,
interesting.
Yeah, there's another, a nice study there to look at all of them. But then, you know, so many are consult cases, you'd really want fresh and do them all at the same time. You know, it's kind of it'd be muddy if you didn't do it that way, I would think.
Any other questions to this case or other comments?
Just out of curiosity,
very nice discussion.
From a soft tissue perspective, do you guys know if it's retained in higher grade or malignant PEComas? Because sometimes those can be difficult to tell from, you know, poorly differentiated or ugly
muscle tumors. I'm not sure the answer to that. That's a great question.
That's the next study.
The metastatic LAM the metastatic PEComa that we have in our series that'll be coming out was one that was more classic PEComa, not super high grade and ugly looking. So there might be something. I know there's a fair amount of literature on GPNMB already in other organ systems. The GU literature has a bunch of published studies on it. I'd have to look and see what there has been written on high grade PEComa. That might have already been done by somebody.
Very good. The last 2 minutes, I just wanted to highlight a few other articles that we are here out for notation or case. One is on histiocytosis and reactive proliferations of histiocytes, current state of the art and evolving concepts. This is basically from a workshop, and it includes everything what you ever wanted to know about any of the histiocytosis, including stains, outcome, and so on. Then there is a study on pulmonary immunohistochemical markers that may be positive in gastric adenocarcinoma, specifically if they are associated with autoimmune metaplastic atrophic gastritis. And that includes TTF1 and NAPSIN. And then there is an ISHLT consensus statement on short telomere syndrome and lung transplantation, which basically has all the clinical information what one may want to know about short telomere syndrome and how these patients are handled. There's also a nice editorial in Virkos Archives about artificial intelligence and the process of publishing scientific manuscripts. So it goes over what should be actually done for regulatory purposes when someone uses AI or should not use AI. And the same is true for editing of publications, but also for editors, how they should or should actually not use AI. And then there is a case study by Andy Chirk and colleagues on mesothelioma in situ with a TP53 mutation. This is a case presentation basically saying that P53 diffuse overexpression can be seen also in mesothelioma in situ. Although the case he presents has mesothelioma in situ, but also invasive mesothelioma. But that is it. And this is at the top of the hour. Thank you very much for your engagement and for joining us today. And have a good day.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Bye, everyone.
Thanks, Sonia. Thank you.